This is the Bible study session. The topic is on the board, he who laughs last, or she who laughs last, depending upon your persuasion. And it is a topical Bible study on Proverbs 17:22. A cheerful heart is good medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bones. I've said all that for the introduction to the tape. Now let me tell you what's really going on, folks. I am not on the staff at Holden Village. I'm one of those high-priced guest lecturers that they brought in. I thought I was going to slip away for a week of R&R up here, but I made the mistake of being in campus ministry for about 20 years and making the acquaintance of a fellow by the name of Elmer Witt during that time. And also I was on the teaching staff here at Holden in 1982. And when Elmer came up to me yesterday and says, "I'm leaving, Ron, you're in charge," or words to that effect, I was both flattered and a little bit reluctant. But anyway, in his skillful way, Elmer convinced me that it would be a great opportunity for me to volunteer for the Bible study this morning and tomorrow morning. So I am here. And because of that last minute kind of thing, this may not be a Bible study in the fullest expectation of your needs. But I am going to do something that the only thing I'm really prepared to do. So if it's a Bible study, fine. If it's not, well, the Lord will forgive. I guess I owe it a little bit to tell you about a little bit about myself. The problem is I'm with a group of about 19 people from San Marcos, Texas, who know more about me than I really want the rest of you to know about. But suffice it to say that I am a Lutheran minister, semi-retired. I was a campus pastor for about 20 years, first at Texas A&M University and then at Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos. I am in my post-midlife crisis, which means that I'm out now freelancing it. As I tell people, I spend about 50% of my time as a rancher. I inherited about 5 years ago a prime Texas hill country Angora goat ranch. How many of you know what Angora goats are? Buy mohair, wear mohair. So I'm doing that, and about a quarter of my time I do this kind of thing. I'm a speaker, retreat leader, conference leader. About a quarter of my time I am an actor in primarily industrial video productions. I am a spokesperson for people who pay, not like Holden. And the other quarter of my time, I am a writer. My primary outlet being a column in the Southern District newsletter of the AOC.
Times up to five quarters.
That's true. I never was very good at math. That's why I went into theology. And if you're wondering how I make my way in life, my wife has a good job. But that's who I am. And as I say, I came here for a week of R&R. And this is the third time that I've been here. Once, the first time that Alberta, my wife, and I were here, we were just spectators. And then the second time, I was on the staff. And now I'm back as both, I guess. I haven't figured that out yet. But I love this place. And I wish it were closer to Texas so that I could come here more often. And there are a couple of things that have always struck me about this place that make it very unique. And those are the things I'd like to talk about in my Bible study sessions with you today and tomorrow. What is tomorrow, I will not tell you. You'll have to come back and see. But today is the general subject of humor. I have been impressed from the first time I stepped on these grounds at the very vital part that humor plays in the Holden experience. I was just commenting with the staff earlier in the Bible study there that The one thing I have missed this year is something that is one of my prized possessions that I bought the last time I was here in the bookstore, and it's not for sale now. It's one of the old towels. I don't know whether any of you are old timers. The sauna towels, the huge beach type towels that has on it hot hilarity. Has anybody seen those? Or I was informed that towels have become more expensive, and that's why they are not selling them, but they're thinking about getting them back. But the whole idea of holy hilarity has always been a very important part of the Holden experience. And I don't know how long you've been here or if you've been here before, but you can't stay around here very long before something funny happens in a holy kind of thing. I was watching last night the Four Seasons production, and just, you know, underlying that whole thing was just a nice big smile, the events that have happened here. And I think that's so important that we need to remember that humor is holy. And that's what I'd like to talk a little bit about this morning. I don't know how many of you remember a famous phrase by one Saint Augustine that says, a Christian should be an alleluia from head to foot. A Christian should be an alleluia from head to foot. That's one of my favorite sayings by Saint Augustine. I think that would be a very saleable t-shirt at Holden Village. And I'll take royalties off that if anybody And I find that a very profound statement with all kinds of implications. Basically, it means that we Christians are to be alleluia people. People who approach life full of joy, full of hope, full of happiness. That we are living alleluias. That everything we do is an expression of the joy, the hope, the carefree spirit, in the real sense of that word, of carefree. The carefree spirit we have as a result of our relationship to God. A Christian should be an alleluia from head to foot. However, that is easier said than done. For example, this incident related by one of America's leading theologians, Irma Bombeck. Share this little story with you. At church the other day, Irma says, I was intent on a small child who was turning around, smiling at everyone. He wasn't gurgling, spitting, humming, kicking, tearing the hymnals, or rummaging through his mother's handbag. He was just smiling. And finally, his mother jerked him about and in a stage whisper that could be heard in a little theater off Broadway said, stop that grinning, you're in church! And with that, she gave him a belt on his hind side, and as the tears rolled down his cheeks, added, that's better! And returned to her prayers. What must they think, asked Irma, these children of the 80s, we sing, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, while our faces reflect the sadness of one who has just buried a rich aunt who left everything she had to her pregnant hamster. And suddenly I was angry. It occurred to me the entire world is in tears, and if you're not, then you'd better get with it. I wanted to grab this child with a tear-stained face close to me and tell him about my God, the happy God, the smiling God, the God who had to have a sense of humor to have created the likes of us. I wanted to tell him he is an understanding God, one who understands little children who pick their noses in church because they're bored, a God who understands the man out in the parking lot reading the comics while waiting for his wife to come out from attending church. He is a God who even understands my shallow prayers that implore, if you can't make me thin, at least make my friends look fat. What a fool, I thought. Here was a woman sitting next to the only light left in our civilization, the only hope, our only miracle, our only promise of infinity. If he couldn't smile in church, where was there left to go? Wise words by Mother Irma. How sad that we Christians are not aware that a Christian should be and can be, hallelujah, from head to foot. They're kind of like a guy in another story by Barbara Jurgensen, who I think has been on the Holden staff. If you don't know the writings of Barbara, you should. But she tells a delightful little story about Petronius. Petronius stood with his weight on one foot, then on the other. The line ahead of him was moving so slowly that it would be ages before he got his turn at the judgment seat. And then he pricked up his nose. What was that delicious smell? And he leaned out of line and he saw an angel coming along the line carrying a tray of hot buttered rolls, and he was holding the tray out to each person in the line. Petronius had been standing in the line so long that he was very hungry, and in a few moments the angel would be offering him a roll, and then he suddenly realized he must not take a roll. All of his life, and he had been a Christian for as long as he could remember, he had done his best to avoid being carried away by pleasurable things. He had seen too many people live only for their own enjoyment, and he had made up his mind that he would not be one of them. For years, therefore, he had deliberately ignored pleasurable things in order to concentrate his attention more fully on serving God. And now the man ahead of him was taking a roll. And now the angel was holding out the tray to Petronius. And the fresh, warm, yeasty smell assailed his nostrils. His mouth began to water. He reached out his hand and then rallied himself enough to pull it back and give the angel an almost convincing no, no thank you. The angel moved on to the next person. The rolls had been almost too much of a temptation. For a moment, he had almost weakened and taken one. But years of self-discipline had come to his rescue at this crucial time. And it was crucial. Perhaps this was a test. Perhaps this was one of God's ways of separating the sheep from the goats. And Petronius felt better as he thought of this because he had passed the test. The line moved ahead little by little. And now a bird began singing in a tree near him, and Petronius looked up, and finally he found singing away on a leafy branch near him a little bluebird. And never had he heard a more beautiful song. And then he turned his head away. One must not get wrapped up in the pleasures of life. And now as the line moved forward, he found himself opposite a large bed of red flowers. Their fragrance was sweet but fresh. And he started over to examine them more closely and then caught himself. One must not be too attracted by beautiful things. The line continued to move along slowly. And now he felt something brushing against his leg. And looking down, he saw a small yellow and white kitten. Meow, said the kitten as it rubbed its back against Petronius's ankle. And Petronius had to employ all of his self-restraint to keep from reaching down and picking up the kitten. But again, his years of giving up pleasurable things shored him up. The line inched slowly forward. And then at last, the man ahead of him stepped to the side, and Petronius found that he was the one before the judgment seat. The judgment seat. He shut his eyes, and he knelt in wonder and awe. And after many moments, he felt God's hand upon his shoulder and heard God saying, "Well done, my son. I'm glad you come home. You've served me faithfully. You've served me well. You've been a most loving son. However, there is just one thing." And here God took Petronius by the hand and lifted him to a standing position. And Petronius opened his eyes and he saw in the air behind God's throne a series of moving pictures. He saw himself as he had lived his life from day to day, grim, tense, unbending, unappreciated. And he saw the cold, unloving effect that it had had on those around him. And then he heard God speaking again. "My son, did you not know that I created all of the good things of the earth for you to enjoy? I wanted you to love me and serve me, but I also wanted you to enjoy the good things I made for you." And then Petronius noticed that God had something on his lap, a small yellow and white kitten, the same kitten that Petronius had so carefully avoided picking up. He noticed, too, that God was taking a moment to listen to the song of the small bluebird in the leafy branch above him. And on the table next to God's throne, he noticed a vase of the fragrant red flowers that he had forced himself to ignore, and a plate with a half-eaten roll. And now in the air behind the throne, he watched these words appear. A man will have to give account on Judgment Day for all the good things he refused to enjoy when he might have done so. Petronius knelt before God once more, and then he hurried out. Angel, he called, running down the line. Angel with the rolls! End of story by Barbara Jurgensen. Like Petronius, I think all of us need to be reminded that a Christian can be an alleluia from head to foot. Reminded that basically Christianity is a joyful religion. As Harry Emerson Fosdick has put it, the New Testament is the most joyful book in the world. It opens with joy over the birth of Jesus, and it ends with a superb picture of a multitude which no man could number singing hallelujah choruses. No matter where you open it, amid fortunate or discouraging circumstances, you always hear the note of joy. Even when a company of friends gather at a farewell supper before their leader is crucified, he says to them, "These things have I spoken unto you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be made full." Even when their best friend has gone, the mourners take their food with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God. If they are flogged for their faith, the disciples depart from the council, rejoicing that they are counted worthy to suffer dishonor for the name. And when an apostle is put in jail overnight, he passes his time singing. And if you listen to him in his Roman prison, you will hear him dictating, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice." There is enough tragedy in the New Testament to make it the saddest book in the world. But instead, it is the most joyful. So says Harry Emerson Fosdick. It is such a faith as that that enables we Christians to be an alleluia from head to foot. And it is that, and in that context, which I believe makes humor holy. The holiness of humor. It is holy. It is a very important part of our faith. And we need make no apologies at all for it. Some other things about humor. Humor is not only holy, humor is healthy. Humor is healthy. First of all, it's good for us mentally and emotionally. This story has made the Texas rounds. I'm not sure it's made the Washington rounds, but you Texans ignore this story. A man was out walking his dog one evening, and it was kind of a hot Texas day, and so he decided he needed him a long, tall Dr. Pepper. So he stopped at the cafe and went in and tied his dog, which is a Great Dane, to a post out in front of the cafe, and he goes inside. Well, the cafe was a Dairy Queen, I'll say that. And goes into the Dairy Queen, and he gets him his long, tall, cool Dr. Pepper, and he's sitting there supping on it and enjoying it. And another guy walks in the room, into the cafe, and says, "Hey, who's the owner of that Great Dane that's tied out in front of the guy?" I said, "I am." "Why?" And he says, "Well, I don't really know how to tell you this, but my dog just killed your dog." The guy says, "What? Your dog killed my dog? What kind of dog you got?" And he says, "I got a Chihuahua." "A Chihuahua? There's no way that a Chihuahua could have killed my Great Dane." The guy said, "Oh, yes, there is. Your Great Dane just choked to death on my Chihuahua." The Chihuahua that is choking many a Great Dane and Great German and Great Norwegian and Great American these days is the Chihuahua of stress. The theme song for many people in our world today has become, "Push, push, push myself everywhere I go. Hurry, 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 I got to get that dough." And as a result of that, stress, I think as we are all aware, is fast becoming public enemy number one. You know stress is a problem when Baskin-Robbins' flavor of the month is Maalox Mousse. In Now, also, if you know anything about our world today, you know that there are a lot of people making lots of suggestions on how to deal with stress. Well, you're going to hear one more. As I mentioned in my introduction, I raise Angora goats as part of my livelihood. And also as a speaker, I'm always looking for stories, and it seems natural to look for goat stories. The problem is there aren't very many good goat stories. If any of you have them, I'll be happy to pay you for them. One good story is, you know, there's a rather common phrase that has been in our language for a long, long time: don't let anybody get your goat. Now, I don't know whether you know where that phrase comes from or not. Well, I've done a little research, and I will pass this on to you. That comes out of horse racing and the fact that thoroughbred horses, as most of you know, are very high-strung animals and very nervous, very tense. So racehorse owners were trying any way they could find to calm their horses down so that when they put them out on the racetrack, they would have all of that energy to put into the race, and they would not use it up pacing their stall or whatever. So they found out, they hit upon the idea of putting a goat in the stall with the racehorse. And this had a very calming effect upon the racehorses. They would lay down the night before the race and get a good rest and go out the next day and be able to perform their best. Well, now, human beings, being the devious types that we are, some racehorse owners hit upon the idea that if they wanted an edge the next day, they would go steal the goat out of their neighbor's stall the night before. And this would upset the racehorse. The racehorse would pace around the stall, use up all that energy, and go out and not perform that well in the race. That is where the phrase, "don't let anybody get your goat," comes from. Aren't you glad you came here this morning? Well, it seems to me as that's a very practical bit of advice. You know, don't let anybody get your goat. That might be one way of dealing with stress. And it seems to me as if one good goat in dealing with stress is humor. I went to a conference, was a participant in a conference at the Presbyterian Holden Ranch several years ago, which is a place called Ghost Ranch in northern New Mexico. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of that place or not. In its own way, it's a very delightful place, and it is open to non-Presbyterians as well as Holden is open to non-Lutherans. So if you ever have an opportunity, I highly recommend it. But they do things a little bit different there than we do here at Holden. They do not have the smorgasbord kind of program. You go there for a conference, and they have a week-long conference on a particular topic. I went there for a conference on Christianity and humor. About the only one on that subject I've ever heard of. It was a delightful experience. And they had a psychiatrist on the staff of this conference from the University of New Mexico Medical School who kept making the point over and over and over again that laughter and joy and good humor and parties and celebrative occasions of any kind, these are not luxuries in life. They are not luxuries in life. These kinds of things, having a good laugh, having a good time, enjoying yourself, those are necessities of life. Necessities. We need them. For good mental health, we all need to be able to go out and have a good time and have a good old laugh and be with friends, because these kinds of things act as buffers against all of the pain and the tragedy and the tension of which this old life is so full. If we couldn't laugh, if we couldn't occasionally go out and let our hair down and have a great good old time, the plain fact of the matter is we'd all go crazy. As the proverb says, a cheerful heart is a good medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bone. So laughter and joy and good humor and celebrative occasions are necessities. They're good therapy. We need them. As the great American philosopher Alfred E. Newman puts it, he who laughs lasts. Humor is good for our health, our mental health. I have recently rediscovered the Jewish stories, the Hasidic tales, delightful parables and stories. And one of my favorites is about a man who's being chased by a tiger. And the tiger chases the man over a cliff, and the guy grabs onto a vine that is growing out of the cliff, and he hangs on there for dear life. And when he looks up, here's the tiger that's been chasing him, looking down at him with drooling eyes. And then he looks down at the bottom of the cliff, and lo and behold, there is another tiger looking up with open mouth, just waiting for the guy to fall. As we'd say in Texas, he's in a predicament. But it's not over yet, because as he hangs there, he suddenly hears some gnawing sounds, and he looks up right above where his two hands are holding onto the vine, and what does he see but two little mice gnawing away in his vine. He is in a fix. Well, as he hangs there, trying to figure out what to do, he looks around, and his eyes fall on a clump of wild strawberries growing out of the cliff. And as he looks at them, he turns loose with one hand from the vine and reaches out and grabs him a handful of those wild strawberries. And he looks at them, and then he begins to taste them one by one. And as he does, a smile slowly appears on his face, and he says, "My, how delicious. My, how delicious." This old life do get tough sometimes. Tigers behind you, tigers ahead of you, little mice gnawing away at your protective vine. But if you look around, there are usually always some strawberries. Delicious, close at hand, just waiting to be tasted. There's a time to worry about tigers. There's a time to worry about mice. But there's also a time to enjoy strawberries. Humor, the good times of life, we need them. They're healthy. They're good for our mental, emotional, and spiritual health. And humor is also healthy for our human relations as we interact with our fellow human beings. It's probably a truism to say that, like it or not, we have to live with people. At home, at work, at play, wherever we are, our life is built around our human relationships. And it's also a truism to say that the whole goodness or badness of our life is built to a great extent on those relationships. If we have bad relationships, if we can't get along with the people we work with, play with, live with, life is going to be miserable. On the other hand, if we enjoy the people we are with, if we're having a good time with those people, chances are very good life is going to be good. And Mark Twain said, not Mark Twain, but that great Dane Victor Borge said, "The shortest distance between two people is laughter." Laughter is very important in our human relationships. Another story. A burglar breaks into a house in the middle of the night. He finds a safe, puts his flashlight on the dial, starts twiddling the dial to see if he can break in. He works on this a few minutes, and suddenly he freezes in terror as he hears right behind his shoulder, and he slowly turns around, and what does he see but this huge Doberman pincher, all set to pounce, fangs bared, mouth wide open. The guy is scared to death. They look at each other eyeball to eyeball for a few moments, and finally the burglar realizes that the dog is not going to do anything but just stand there and so he says, "What the heck?" And he turns around and he starts working on the safe again. A few minutes pass. He freezes in terror again as he hears a voice behind him, a voice saying, "It is illegal to break into a safe." And he slowly turns around, and what does he see but a parrot standing on the back of the Doberman pincher saying over and over and over again, "It is illegal to break into a safe. It is illegal to break into a safe." Well, slowly the burglar gets his wits back about him, and comes to the realization again that the dog is not going to pounce, the parrot is not going to do anything. They're just going to sit there, the dog panting and the parrot repeating over and over and over again, it is illegal to break into a safe. So he turns back to his business at hand, twiddling with the dials, but he can't concentrate with all this racket going on behind him. So finally he turns around and he says, "Will you two cut it out? Dog, all you do is stand there and parrot, you just stand on the back of him and say over and over and over again, it's illegal to break into a safe, it's illegal to break into a safe. Parrot, don't you know any other words?" And the parrot smiles and says, "Yes, sick 'em." Motivation, getting people to sick 'em, is an important part of most of our lives too, whether we are parents trying to motivate our children, spouses trying to motivate our spouses, spice, whatever you call them, bosses trying to motivate workers, whatever. A very important part of most of our lives is motivation, getting people to sick 'em in one form or another. How do we do that? Well, again, I think that humor plays a very important part in that. Some of you may remember Aesop's old fable of the wind and the sun, who are getting a little conversation about who has the most power, and they decide they will check it out and have a little contest. So they see this traveler on the road going along wearing a heavy cloak, and so they decide to have a little contest to see who can get the traveler to remove his cloak. So the wind goes first, and the wind blows in huffs and puffs and gusts and gales, but the stronger he blows, the closer the traveler pulls his cloak around him. So then it's the sun's turn, and the sun kind of, you know, comes out, and just a typical kind of sunshiny weather, and then it gets a little warmer, and finally in full noonday splendor turns on all of his warmth, and the traveler begins to unbutton his cloak and finally just throws his cloak off altogether. I don't know about you, but in my own experience in human relations, I found that when I try to work with the wind philosophy, that doesn't work very well. The wind of criticism and complaint and nagging only causes people to hold their protective cloak. Being dealt with warmth, usually accompanied by twinkling eyes and smiling lips and warm, witty words, that causes people to open up, throw off their protective cloak, and real human interaction and relationships can begin to happen. My life has been full of those kinds of experiences, as I'm sure yours has too. I'd like to just share one of them with you. It was back when I was a college student at Texas Lutheran College, and the president then was the sainted Dr. William F. Crowshar, whom some of you from outside of Texas may have even heard of. Dr. Crowshar was known affectionately to all of us as Prexy. And this was back about 1953, and I was a college student at TLC, and I was living in an old surplus army barracks called North Hall, and it was a warm Texas day, and I came in hot and tired and went to get myself a Coke. And it was a classic Coke days. I think I need to start talking about Cokes nowadays. You have to do all these definitions. But anyway, when I went to put my nickel in, and that also tells you how long ago it was, into the machine, I discovered that the door was open. Come to find out, the delivery man had just been there, and when he had left, he had not shut the door to the Coke machine properly. So, you know, when I went to mess with it, it came wide open. Well, not being then of the strong moral fiber that I am today, I found that I could not resist this unexpected treasure, so I promptly loaded up a case of the Cokes and took them and put them in the closet in my dorm room. Well, it wasn't very long before the whole dorm heard about the free Cokes, and man, they hit it, and it was wiped out. And also, it wasn't very long then when the Coke company found out about it and passed it on, so that it wasn't very long before Dr. Kreischer found out about it. Well, the next day, Prexy called a meeting of all the dorm residents, and in his warm, courteous, gentle Christian style, he informed all of us of his great disappointment in us as young Christian gentlemen. But he also very firmly informed us of the consequences if it was found out who it was that had broken into the machine. Well, I may be a sinner, but I have never been accused of being a dumb sinner. So, reading the handwriting on the wall, I decided that confession was the wisest thing to do. So, I went up to Prexy and told him that the machine had not been broken into, because, and I knew because I was the first one that had gotten there, and it just hadn't been shut properly. And then, rather reluctantly, I admitted that I had taken a case of the Cokes and they were in my room still. And then it was that I heard had the totally unexpected reaction of Prexy putting his hand on my shoulder, looking me squarely in the face and saying, "Burke, I want to commend you. I want to commend you for putting those Cokes away so the other boys couldn't steal them." Well, that was the day I learned something about the grace of God and the graciousness of his servant, William F. Kreischer. It was also the day that the sun shone on me, a day that I was dealt with warmly and humanly. It was a day that I've never forgotten, and I think in its own small way, that was a day that has probably influenced much of my life, my own style and my own way of dealing with other people. It was the day I learned something about the importance of good humor and warmth in one's human relationships. Well, the point of all that is that humor is healthy. Healthy for our human relationships, healthy for our mental, emotional, spiritual health. Humor is holy. So smile. Just for the health of it. And with that, as Lady Godiva said at the end of her famous ride, I come to my close. Now, that supposedly was a Bible study, a topical Bible study. And I would like, for the rest of our time, for us just to open it up for your reactions. If you'd like to supplement, argue, or whatever. Yes, sir.
I've got two things in mind. One of them, somewhere I read, the author was quoting a Chinese man as saying, "Americans don't really enjoy themselves. They laugh too much and laugh too loud." The other point I'd like to bring up is, a great deal of what passes for humor seems to be bringing pain upon some victim.
Yes. Humor, like everything else, is, not like everything else, but many things else, what's the word I mean? Anyway, is neutral, what I'm trying to say. And we human beings can take it and make it into something good or something evil. Yes, there is bad, negative humor. I was not talking about that here. There's no question. The obscenity, the humor, the derisive humor that makes fun of people, ethnic humor, most of it, yes, that can be, in my definition of the term, bad humor. So I would agree with that. But I'm not here to talk about that. I would like to emphasize the good side of humor. All of the positive effects of that. The first reaction to the first one may tie in with the second, that a lot of humor for a lot of people becomes or laughter becomes a mask to hide us, really. That we don't want to reveal ourselves, so we do laugh loud and long. Good comment on that. Other comments or reactions?
Well, to the second one is humor is not just jokes. Humor is more than just jokes, right?
Go ahead.
I mean, it's a whole attitude. It's when we talk about humor, we always seem to think about telling jokes, and it's not just that.
What is it?
It's seeing funny things in life, seeing good things, seeing it in situations, you know, seeing a bad situation, like the mouse and the tigers. You know. That's the kind of humor I'm thinking of, not just necessarily telling funny jokes.
Yeah. Like the other night when the lady was eating the peanuts and dropping the shells and there was a mouse under her feet and she didn't know it, you know.
Humor is a little bit like jazz. Somebody asked Louis Armstrong once, can you define jazz for me? He said, well, if you have to define it, you don't know what it is. And I think we get in a big problem sometimes if we really try to dissect and analyze what humor is. I think we all know what's good humor, what makes us feel good and what is pleasant and good for us. And I think it is much broader than jokes. Yeah, I would agree with that a little hard. Yes?
A big part of it is not taking oneself too seriously.
Would you care to expand on that?
Well, I think that's how you see the humor in situations, the ability to laugh at yourself.
Yeah, somebody has said, as long as you can laugh in the mirror, there's hope. I think that to me is grace. That I don't know about you, but I've always noticed that the really fanatics in life, whether they're far left or far right, usually do not have a sense of humor. You ever notice that? They take life too seriously, and as a result, they just screw life up, theirs and everybody else's. And it seems to me as if humor, in the good sense of the word, and being able to laugh at yourself is the surest sign of good health that there is. And I say that out of years of experience as a pastor and as a counselor. That to me is all. If I could see that in somebody, I felt that there was really hope for their healing.
There's read Norman Cousins' book, Anatomy of an Illness. There's more and more incidental type things that are coming in. The humor plays a good role in a person's not only mental health but physical health as well. There's a direct correlation a lot of times between how a person or what they think of themselves and how healthy they are too. Like I said, you can't take yourself too seriously.
One part of this presentation that I left out today for time reasons and other is humor is good for your physical health. And Norman Cousins' book, Anatomy of an Illness, is the classic one right now. That is in the library and I think in the bookstore. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. It's been made into a TV movie, so everybody should know about it. But basically, it is just Norman Cousins was a longtime editor of Saturday Review and was became the victim of a life-threatening illness, and just about everybody had given up hope, and so he got involved in his own healing, which is the basic premise of the book. But a very important part of that was he was a friend of Alan Funt. Remember Alan Funt with Candid Camera? And Alan Funt brought him in some old episodes from Candid Camera, as well as some Marx movies and other comedy classics. And so his cousin started prescribing himself 10 minutes a day, I think it was, dosage of laughter. And they were monitoring all the physical effects of this. Well, to make a long story short, he was, quote, healed by this. And, you know, that's simplifying it. There were other factors. And as a result, wrote this up for medical journals, and the book came out of it. And he is the in guy in the med profession now, going around to medical schools, being visiting professors and everything else. The good thing about this, from my point of view, is that it has really legitimatized the place of humor in healing. And I read rather regularly in newspapers and magazines and other periodicals about another hospital that has set up a laughing room for its terminally ill people, where they can go and view these kinds of films and things, and how therapeutic it is. The other part of that, since you started this, and you may know more about this than I, but the whole physical effects that laughter has, just having a good old belly laugh brings in oxygen, which does all kinds of things to your body, which creates, what is it, endorphins or whatever, the natural tranquilizers. And we all know what a laugh does to our muscles, how it relaxes them. There's just all physiologically, laughter is good medicine. There's no question about it. Would you care to expand on?
Well, I don't really think it could. I think reading his book, reading, listening to his tapes is a good eye-opener. But there's more and more evidence coming in that it has a direct correlation between, you know, how much painkiller a person needs in the hospital. He gave an example, we listened to him one time, about people in a VA hospital that were, quote, terminally ill, and how they could come in and just by sharing humorous instances that happened to them, how the pain medication dosage went way down, people will start having a little more hope in their life too.
How do you incorporate humor into your ministry then?
My ministry? Well, yeah, I think in general that we in the Lutheran Church maybe need to rediscover humor. And I'm proud to say I think we're seeing more and more of that. Not just the joke telling. This is where I am a little disturbed sometimes by ministers who just start telling jokes in their sermons or something with no connection or whatever. Something that can be done, but it takes a pretty creative art to do that. But you can still make a presentation, for example, with good humor. Fritz Norstedt is a perfect example. You sit and he tells, you know, his presentation night before last on chaos was one of the most gut-wrenching things I've heard in a long, long time, and yet it was all done warmly and, by my definition at least, in good humor. That, I think, is a good example of it. Humor is, anybody who is involved in the communications arts, either as a speaker or a television producer or a writer or whatever, knows the importance of humor in communication, that people want humor. They need humor to hang the thoughts on. We need to learn that, I think, in sermonizing and teaching and all that kind of thing. And maybe, most importantly, just in our interhuman relations. I do workshops on putting a smile in your church, which basically encourages fellowship experiences, suppers, softball, whatever can get people together and where they can experience each other in a non-threatening, fun experience. And that's the way I think we get to know each other. That we have good times, and then out of those, the relationship that builds, then we get to know each other deeply as persons, and we begin to open up, and all our hurts and cares come out. So I think that may be the most important place of humor in the church. Yes?
Do you feel that a man has a different sense of humor than a woman?
Right, which I say.
I'm serious now.
I think all of us have different senses of humor because
on a general scope, there are certain type of stories or jokes that will touch the funny bone differently for a group of men than for a group of women.
That's a cultural thing. That's very based on their past experience.
It's a cultural thing.
Yeah, I think all humor is based on your experience. You've got to know something before you can laugh at it. And And women, yes, have generally different experiences than men. In that sense, yeah, I think maybe a motherhood joke would be more humorous to a mother than it would to a father or those kinds of, if that's what you're talking about. Yeah. I don't know. Does anybody else feel about that?
I think women are intelligent enough that if they were exposed to the same background and heard the same joke, they would see the same
Oh, that was well put. And I think men are intelligent enough, too.
I wonder if a positive attribute helps one enjoy humor, or if the humor helps one toward a positive attitude. So if humor could help us be more positive, then I think it's a wonderful thing. There's a group in Denver called TPF, Total Persons Facilitation, and they suggest a couple things. One thing is to stand in front of the mirror the first thing you get out of the morning and look in the mirror and say, I look good, I feel great, I see myself radiate. They call it the should have, would have, ought to, and all these things that that we do. I should have done this. I ought to have done this. I wish I could have done this. And then when something funny comes up, they'll just bring the doll and they'll use that doll for that certain thing to get that discussion going. But I think anything that helps toward positive attitude is wonderful.
Oh yeah, we've made fun, I think, of Norman Vincent Peale's power of positive thinking. We good intellectual Christians saying that that's, you know, just too superficial, and there are a lot of holes in that. You can't have, you know, just a rosy attitude towards life and ignore all the bad things. But there is a lot to thinking positive. And again, Fritz got into that about looking at life positively in all the chaos, looking for the pony. I think that, yeah, that really does affect one's attitude towards life. And I think all of us know people who are the eternal optimist and people who are the eternal pessimist. And I don't know whether my golf partner is in here, he's not, but so I can say this, but one of his friends who he likes to play golf with is a guy who never hits a good shot. You know, oh, it's terrible. God, just terrible. He'll make a 50-foot putt. Oh, I should have made, you know, and he'll complain. Well, it drives me nuts. I just really rather not play with him. On the other hand, those of us Texans know, and a fellow by the name of Jim Wacker, who the whole world is going to discover, he's now the head football coach at Texas Christian University. Good Lutheran, and he is the eternal optimist, and that's why he's such a successful football coach. He took Texas Lutheran College to two national championships, Southwest Texas, where we are, two national championships, and went to TCU, who had been the eternal doormat of the Southwest Conference, and turned them around in 2 years, and almost came within that close of winning the Southwest Conference and going to the Cotton Bowl, but didn't, so he ended up in the Blue Bonnet Bowl. But Wacker just, you know, and that's what he does with athletes. He goes out and he says, hey, you may not be the world's greatest, but let's find, what are your talents? What can you do? And then do the best. His motto is, do your best and don't sweat the rest, which is a little But Wacker's always up, and you know, he's a joy to be around. And he turned the whole community of Fort Worth, Texas, which is no small community, now is just got a big smile on their face. They're just Wacker backers and ballers. Here's a guy who yeah, he's in a very visible position, but through his positive attitude, he did it in our community. It just turned the whole town upside down around a stupid thing like football. Got the Mexicans and the Americans together. They were all Bobcat backers, and you know, a unifying thing there. And if a guy can have that kind of effect, that to me is holy. That's good. And that to me is what humor and positive thinking is all about in the Christian sense of the word. So yes, there are optimists and pessimists in this world. And I'd rather be an optimist because I think that's Christian. And that's going to be a good place to... Yes?
One thing about being an optimist, though, everybody makes fun of it and they don't like optimists.
Yeah, there's always...
that's been my experience.
Yeah, there's always somebody filling the room full of horse manure, yeah. But you can counteract that by looking for the pony. I love that story.